Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
For the last two decades, it's been illegal for private groups that run literacy and job training programs to hire and fire employees based on their religious beliefs. That may change today. Under the $4 billion Workforce Investment Act, expected to pass in the House, it will be legal for those running some federally funded programs to choose staff based on their faith. Joining us to discuss the legislation is Massachusetts Congressman Barney Frank, who opposes the portion of the bill having to do with this new approach to hiring and firing. Welcome, Congressman Frank.
Thank you for a chance to talk about a very important issue.
Thank you very much. Now, how would the provision of the bill you oppose work?
Very straightforwardly. The current law, which was sponsored, by the way, by Senator Dan Quayle, says in this program you cannot discriminate based on race, sex, national origin, and religion. The Republicans have brought a bill to the floor which leaves the word religion out. So it would now give an explicit approval, because when you have something in the law and then you take it out consciously, you're explicitly approving this policy. And it means that people will get federal money for entirely secular purposes, training people to get jobs, and be able to say, we're only hiring Scientologists, we're only hiring Orthodox Jews, we're only hiring born-again Baptists. It's appalling. Even more appalling in many ways is, we offered an amendment, the Democrats did, in the committee to knock this out. It lost on a party-line vote. We're now on the floor of the House. We went to the committee, which sets the terms for debate, the Rules Committee, and said, please allow us to offer this amendment. We are debating a proposal by the Republicans not even to allow a vote on this. That is, it'll only be part of the overall bill. There won't be a separate vote. And this is the first time, really, since Brown against Board of Education in 1954, that the federal government is being asked to not only not fight discrimination, but to sanction it.
Congressman, supporters of the bill, this portion of the bill, say certain organizations will refuse to run their programs without the new provision because they worry about lawsuits based on discrimination. What about that?
That's their right. Religious groups have a right to decide not to participate. What they don't have a right to do, they have a right to run their own operations. The question is whether they should be able to get taxpayer dollars, whether taxpayers of all religions should be taxed to pay for these programs, and then some of the taxpayers be told by one of these groups, thanks for the tax money, but you're a Jew, we're not going to hire you.
Yeah, but if some of these programs back away, we so badly need these programs. Isn't it more important to keep these programs up and running than to worry about...
I doubt that there's anybody in America who could say that with a straight face. In the first place, the programs have been running. The notion that people can't do these things without the right to discriminate makes no sense. This is a change. The law against discrimination has been there. And the notion that you can't run a program unless you have only Baptists or Catholics or Mormons doing it, that's not a serious argument. This is just they want to discriminate. It's got nothing to do with the ability to run the programs, which have been running under these non-discrimination laws for a long time.
Right. Congressman, finally then, you know, President Bush did not really succeed with his broad faith-based initiative, but he did sign an executive order in December allowing religious groups to compete for federal funds. Is this part of a larger strategy?
Yes, it is. It's part of a strategy to give religious groups, frankly, a preference, partly for ideological reasons, partly for political reasons. He did do this by executive order. That's one reason why they have to try to get this law changed. An executive order cannot repeal a statute. An executive order can set a policy. We can fight about how far it can go. But where there's an explicit statute on the books that say you can't discriminate, an executive order can't undo this. Now, the Senate refused to do it, and the Senate may refuse to do this one again. What's interesting is that they wanted to make this part of their overall bill, and a provision allowing religious discrimination in all federal programs was proposed by them to the Senate, and it couldn't pass. They didn't even want to put it to a vote because they knew it would lose.
Thank you, Congressman. Massachusetts Congressman Barney Frank spoke to us from Washington. Republican Congressman John Bonner and Howard McKeon, who support the bill, were unavailable for comment.
In another move on the Hill, a measure to continue the 1994 ban on semi-automatic assault rifles will be introduced in the Senate today, and President Bush is expected to support it, to the disappointment of many of his core constituents. The ban on the sale and ownership of certain assault weapons expires next year, and many gun rights groups, including the National Rifle Association, have said they'll make it a top priority to overturn the measure. Well, joining us on the line from Virginia is Andrew Arulanandam. He's Director of Public Affairs for the NRA. And, Mr. Arulanandam, your reaction to President Bush's decision?
Obviously, we're disappointed. However, the real theater of action on this matter will be the United States Congress. That is where the matter will be debated and the issue analyzed, and we will work with members of Congress to ensure that they have all the facts necessary to ensure that this ineffective law sunsets.
Well, Grover Norquist, an NRA board member, as you know, is quoted in today's New York Times as saying, "This is a president who has been so good on the Second Amendment that it's unbelievable to gun owners that he would sign the ban." How much does this hurt the relationship between your organization and President Bush?
Well, the president made similar statements on this matter during the 2000 campaign, so we weren't really surprised. The president supports us on our number one legislative priority this year, and that is the passage of lawsuit preemption legislation that would prevent frivolous lawsuits aimed at driving gun manufacturers out of business.
We should say that we covered that topic, and some would say that some of those lawsuits are not so frivolous, but you're right in pointing out that President Bush has backed you on that issue. But again, why do you think he's not backing you on this one now?
I think that's a question that you should be addressed to the president.
Hmm. Well, in the New York Times article that I mentioned, a gun owner from Arizona is quoted as saying that there are a lot of gun owners who worked hard to put President Bush in office, and there are a lot of gun owners who feel betrayed by him. So I'm wondering, do you think that this decision by the president puts him in a precarious position, or does it reflect that maybe he doesn't feel that he needs the support of your organization as much as he once did because of his popularity?
I think that would be a question best posed to the president and his political advisors.
Well, your thoughts?
We have a constituency, and we have a fiduciary responsibility to uphold Second Amendment rights, and we will work hard to ensure that the Second Amendment rights of all law-abiding Americans are protected. We've been around for 132 years, and we've been doing this for 132 years, and we'll do it for as long as it's needed.
Mm-hmm. Will your organization continue to support President Bush financially and in other ways?
President Bush has been a strong supporter of Second Amendment rights. NRA members and gun owners had to live through 8 years of draconian gun control laws under the Clinton-Gore administration. Keep in mind that the prior administration did not even recognize the Second Amendment as an individual right, something that this administration does and something that we're very grateful for.
Well, Mr. Arulanandam, thank you.
It was a pleasure.
Andrew Arulanandam is Director of Public Affairs for the National Rifle Association based in Virginia.
British Prime Minister Tony Blair is celebrating his 50th birthday this week, buoyed by polls that show he's as popular now as when he first took office in 1997. And this only weeks after he seemed one of the few people in all Great Britain with no doubts about going to war in Iraq. Not having such a good week, one of England's most demonstrative doubters of war in Iraq. The Labour Party has suspended George Galloway, member for Glasgow Central, saying his fiery condemnations of war on Iraq, quote, brought the party into disrepute. On Abu Dhabi television, a week or so into the war, Galloway called British and U.S. soldiers wolves, and he called for an Arab oil boycott of the West. He's also being investigated for allegedly taking over $500,000 from the government of Saddam Hussein. Mr. Galloway now joins us from London. Welcome, Mr. Galloway. Thanks for joining us.
May I just correct an important fact?
Please.
The reason why I was so keen to talk to you, being from Boston, is that I'm suing the Christian Science Monitor, which is based in your fair city, who have alleged not $500,000, but $10 million over 11 years from Saddam Hussein. These are lies of fantastic proportions, as anyone who knows me finds them completely laughable, but they're far from funny. And I will see the Christian Science Monitor and the Daily Telegraph in court, and I believe they will pay very heavily for the lies that they have told about me.
Well, let's turn to the Daily Telegraph. Now, the Daily Telegraph reported that papers were found in a foreign ministry building in Baghdad, supposedly from an Iraqi spy chief, suggesting that you, George Galloway, had demanded money from the Iraqi regime. Your reaction to that?
Well, it's a complete fabrication. I'm not in a position yet to say the provenance of the document, but I am indisputably in a position to say that it is simply not true. And to publish it without a scintilla of justification or evidence, and even the newspaper is not saying it has any evidence that this allegation is true. Indeed, we're told in the legal press that they're not even going to seek to defend the allegation as being true in the court, merely claiming qualified privilege that they found it in a document and thought the public should know that it was in the document. We, of course, hope to defeat that coward's defense in the court. It is flatly a lie.
Why do you think you were suspended from the Labour Party?
Well, the Labour Party says that I'm suspended, as your introduction said, because of my fiery broadcasts on Arab television. And I say that it's come to something when we could be going to war for freedom of speech in Baghdad whilst punishing people for free speech in England. And I can tell you that I am literally deluged. Thousands of people, thousands, in the last 24 hours have emailed me, written to me, or telephoned me. Over 3,000 emails this morning when my staff opened my computer. So the public reaction is very hostile amongst people often who completely disagree with my views about Iraq, but who don't want a parliament of yes-men, a parliament of poodles who follow the leader. That's the kind of parliament they had in Baghdad.
Any discomfort on your part, nonetheless, Mr. Galloway, that you ended up, however well-intentioned some of what you have done, you ended up positioning yourself as the defender of what most people agree was a tyrannical regime of Saddam Hussein?
Well, I knew the tyrannical regime when Britain and America were selling them guns and gas. I used to be standing outside the Iraqi embassy in London protesting for human rights and democracy in Iraq when British businessmen and ministers were inside doing trade and arms deals. So I have nothing to defend on that point. I was the defender not of Saddam Hussein, but of the 23 million Iraqis who were not Saddam Hussein, but who were nonetheless being slaughtered. And that's the only word for it. Madeleine Albright, in words that will follow her to hell, said that it was a price worth paying. I didn't accept that. I don't believe the death of any child is a price worth paying because of a political dispute between our governments and theirs. Those little children in Iraq didn't choose their government. We chose their government, and we kept it in power, and we armed it, including with chemical weapons. So I'm not the hypocrite in this. I'm against all dictatorships at all times, not just some dictatorships some of the time.
Finally, Mr. Galloway, how concerned are you that this all, in the end, could cost you your seat in Parliament?
Oh, it won't cost me my seat in Parliament. It might cost me my membership of the Labour Party. But the only people who can cost me my seat in Parliament are my constituents in the city of Glasgow, and let me assure you, they're fully behind me.
George Galloway, we thank you so much.
You're welcome.
For speaking
Thanks
with
very
us.
Much.
Thanks
Bye.
Very much. George Galloway is a Labour Party Member of Parliament from Glasgow.
Just ahead, the Dean of Foreign Correspondents in Jerusalem on the past and the rocky road ahead and the roadmap to peace.
And later in the program, for some hockey fans, it's all about the fights.
There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
The present blueprint for peace between the Israelis and Palestinians is the so-called roadmap. the three-phased process that would culminate in a Palestinian state in 2 years. On prospects for the roadmap, on whether things could finally turn out right after so much that's gone wrong, we thought we'd check in with the Dean of Foreign Correspondence in Jerusalem, Charles Enderlin, who's reported from the city since 1968. Charles has a new book called Shattered Dreams, which some are calling the definitive book on what the 1990s meant for peace between Jews and Palestinians. Charles Enderlin joins us now in the studio. Welcome, Charles.
Thank you.
Charles, let's go back to the beginning. 1992, 1993, the Oslo peace process. There are people dancing in the streets in Israel and in the territories. What most fundamentally went wrong that spirit of reconciliation and hope was
for the Israelis,
removed from the picture?
For the Israelis, it meant the end of terrorism, the end of fear, the end of feelings that, that deep feelings that you shouldn't send your kid to school because a bus might explode or might bomb. So the Israelis expected this fear to evaporate. The Palestinians were expecting a state at the end, ultimately, with the West Bank, with East Jerusalem, and with what is for the Jews the Temple Mount, of the Palestinians, the Holy Mosques. And on both sides, very fast, we saw, one, terrorism, and two, a daily deterioration of the life of the Palestinians. Oslo brought to the Palestinians more checkpoint, more settlement, more difficulties in their daily life, more unemployment. And secondly, all those suicide bombings inside Israel brought fear to the Israeli street. And I believe this is a major error of the Palestinians in that strategy, because, after all, the only ones who one day will be able to give a state to the Palestinians will be the Israelis. Not the American, not the UN, not Europe, but the only ones who can make the ultimate concession and accept a Palestinian state will be the Israelis.
The decade of the 90s began with the Oslo peace process. By the end of the Clinton administration, there was Camp David, kind of a last-ditch attempt to pull something out of the decade that had such high hopes at one point. You've done as careful and definitive a study as anyone on what happened at Camp David. What went wrong at Camp David?
Camp David was badly prepared on one major subject, that is East Jerusalem. After 10 days already of negotiations at Camp David, suddenly Prime Minister Barak has a major meeting with all his advisors and negotiators, and they discuss what they can do about Jerusalem. This means that the file was not ready. They came without having really prepared the discussion about Jerusalem. By the way, this is what the Palestinian, what Arafat said before going to Camp David: "You are not ready even on Jerusalem." That's true. There were no serious pre-discussion about East Jerusalem before Camp David. But again, Camp David was only one stage, one step in the negotiation. 48 hours after Camp David ended, the negotiators met again and discussed, and ultimately the negotiations stopped only in Taba 10 days before the Israeli elections.
Right. Elections won overwhelmingly by present Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, who, of course, never supported the Oslo peace process. Do you despair of there now ever being a settlement?
In fact, the negotiations on final status, the real negotiation at the finishing line about peace between Israel and Palestine, they started seriously in March 2000. They ended because the Israeli elections were too near, and in the end of February 2001. That's what, that 9-10 months. Compare it with the Israeli-Egyptian negotiations. Started in November 77, and we had an Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty 2 years, almost 2 years later. There was not enough time. This was possible. Simply, even today, you discuss with the negotiators of Taba. They tell you, we can pick up the file where they were, and we can get an agreement with it a few weeks, maybe 2 or 3 months to draft it. But now today's situation has totally changed on the ground, with the settlement, with the road, with the closure, with the intifada. The general feeling from the Israelis and from the Palestinians is that the other doesn't want peace. The dream of one side is a nightmare of the other.
Right. The second intifada, the uprising, the bitterness now. Given all this history, what do you think of the prospects for the new so-called roadmap now in the hands of the different parties drawn up by the U.S., Russia, the European Union, and the U.N.? What do you think of the roadmap as a way to peace?
I believe this is a faint glow at the end of the tunnel. It's the first time for many months, years, that there is such a faint glow at the end of the tunnel. But the first stages of this roadmap will be so difficult to implement that the probability that it will fail is greater than the probability it will succeed. They must first of all return calm and security in the West Bank, in Gaza, in Jerusalem, and this will be a giant task. And I don't believe that without a serious external help, the Palestinians will be able to rebuild the security service and impose the will of the new government to part of the street who doesn't want to stop fighting and to stop acts of terrorism. On the other hand, there is nothing else to do but just to try.
Charles Enderlin, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Charles Enderlin is a longtime correspondent for French television in Jerusalem and author of the new book, Shattered Dreams.
Tomorrow on Here Now, an American photojournalist returns to Nicaragua for the first time since the 1980s, finding many of the same problems he saw when he left.
And our human film reviewers offer their thoughts on the mutants who return to the silver screen in X2, X-Men United. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community, on the web at MathWorks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, state budget cuts nationwide are cutting into Medicaid. We consider the troubled state of federal health care funding for the poor and elderly.
And some hockey stars you might not be familiar with.
Todd the Lunchbox Fedoric, or Todd the Fridge Fedoric. Dave the Hammer Schultz. Stu the Grim Reaper Grimson. Rob Razor Ray. Marty the Meat Grinder Melnichuk, one of our favorites. Doug the Thug Smith, which also couples with Doug the Hammer Smith.
Well, we'll meet Doug the Thug, self-proclaimed goon, and find out about the subculture of hockey fight fans.
Coming up, Here and Now.
I'm Gina Cervetti. An American soldier has been killed in a shooting on a Baghdad bridge. U.S. military officials say an Iraqi walked up to the soldier and opened fire with a pistol. The unidentified soldier was part of the 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment. A doctor treating Jessica Lynch says the former prisoner of war has no memory of what happened when she was captured in Iraq. Dr. Greg Argyris tells NBC's Today Show Lynch may never regain those memories.
Anytime anybody goes through a traumatic event of any kind, there is the risk that they may have a period that they don't remember what happened during that time period. It appears after the evaluations that we have done thus far that there's a chance in the future that she may, but the likelihood is very low. She will remember any of the events.
The doctor says Lynch is being treated for several injuries and is making progress. Lynch was rescued in a commando raid, but Iraqi doctors say they'd tried to turn her over but were fired upon by U.S. forces. The U.S. says more than 7,000 Iraqis captured during the war are being released. Officials say about half were low-level soldiers, and many were Iraqi civilians in the wrong place at the wrong time. About 2,000 prisoners remain in U.S. custody. The Al-Qaeda terrorist network has apparently reorganized and is reportedly planning another terrorist attack against the U.S. The London-based Arabic magazine Al-Majalla says that it has done a series of email interviews with a person claiming to be a spokesman for Al-Qaeda. The spokesman says the organization is planning a strike on the scale of the September 11th attacks. U.S. officials say that such email interviews are not easy to authenticate. The World Health Organization is warning that the SARS virus is more deadly than first thought. The WHO says the death rate for the disease is higher than original estimates of 6 to 10%. The revised rate is 15%. The UN agency also says more than half of those over age 65 who contract severe acute respiratory syndrome may die. 33 people are dead after a passenger train sliced into a double-decker bus south of Budapest in Hungary. All of the victims were German tourists on the bus. 9 others were injured. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow is down 76 points at 84.85, and the Nasdaq is off 15 at 14.92. You're listening to Here and Now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Across the country, millions of low-income Americans depend on the Medicaid program to pay for their health care needs. During the 1990s, many state legislatures made it easier for people to qualify for Medicaid. More people on Medicaid meant fewer uninsured people. But states can no longer be so ambitious or so generous. Revenues are down and Medicaid costs are skyrocketing. So states are cutting back. In Oregon, the legislature is considering ending coverage for 100,000 adults. They are not blind or disabled or elderly, so they don't automatically qualify for Medicaid. They're just poor. Massachusetts ended coverage for 39,000 poor adults in April. James Feldman is an emergency room doctor at the Boston Medical Center. He and his colleagues are seeing an increase in the number of uninsured people coming in the door.
I think that at this point in Massachusetts, you're seeing a real across-the-board rising storm. It's the calm before the tidal wave hits. One of the nurse practitioners in urgent care told me that she's seen 23 patients alone since April 1st who have required medication prescription refills because they've run out of medications, including one patient who had severe hypertension. Psychiatry is also seeing a significant increase in the number of patients who have lost Medicaid coverage and are uninsured. Some patients have reported relapsing and losing their recovery because of loss of addiction service or access to methadone maintenance, which they've been on chronically. One of the residents was mentioned to me this morning was a woman who had pneumonia that could not afford her medications and was admitted through the emergency department with a fever of 105, and it was presumably a preventable admission had the patient received appropriate care.
The Bush administration wants to reform Medicaid. The president wants to give upfront cash bonuses to the states, but end the current practice of matching whatever the states spend on Medicaid. Tom Scully is the federal administrator of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid. Welcome, Mr. Scully.
Thanks for having me on.
Mr. Scully, 34 states are now already spending more money than they say they're taking in, and 28 of those states say their biggest problem is Medicaid spending. Won't turning over more authority for administering Medicaid funds to the states lead inevitably to cuts in health care for the poor?
Well, we're obviously trying to do everything we can to avoid reducing health care for the poor. During the Bush administration, we've expanded Medicaid coverage to about a little over 2 million people, and we're obviously proud of that. But with the economy turning down, it's largely a state-managed program. The federal government pays about 57% of the costs, and the states pay about 43%. But the states really control the policy, and when states have a hard time coming up with their 43% on average, they have the ability to drop coverage, and we're doing everything we can to avoid that. But states are feeling a big financial squeeze, as we are at the federal level, and they are, in many cases, starting to drop some of their optional populations, and obviously we're not excited about that, but we're doing the best we can to help them avoid that. But obviously many states are having major fiscal problems.
So is the administration, in effect, conceding the field that the uninsured is simply a problem, the 44 million or so uninsured is simply a problem we can't do anything about?
No. The president has a very aggressive – the last 2 years we've got not enough focusing on Congress, but the president proposed a $90 billion tax credit. But essentially what it is a payment to buy low-income families and individuals insurance that would take about 6 million people off the uninsured rolls. And we've got very little traction in Congress on that. We're still very aggressively for it. So we're very interested in knocking down the level of the uninsured. But I think the issue here is the states are not talking about covering more people. They're talking about transferring the costs from the state governments to the federal government. We're not talking about covering more people. And we're happy to do that in the short term. All we're saying is we'll give you more money for the next couple of years and the economy is not going well, but then we expect to have it be a partnership over the next 10 years. So, and again, it's totally voluntary. And if you look at states like Oregon or Tennessee that have come in and done broad-based waivers statewide, their programs already work this way.
So Medicaid costs going up, state revenues going down. Cuts
are more than happy to help them out in the short term, but as a permanent matter, having the federal government just come in and give them, instead of 57% of the program spending, 59 or 60% permanently, does not make sense. Temporarily, we'll do it.
You're saying cuts are inevitable in Medicaid?
No, I don't think so. I think that there have been a lot of program expansions in the last couple of years, and I think many states are either stopping their expansions or trimming them back. That's unfortunate given the economics of the time, but I think the Medicaid program is still going to keep growing, and it's expected to grow 13% this year.
Tom Scully, thanks very much.
Okay, thanks.
Tom Scully is with the Department of Health and Human Services in Washington. He's the administrator of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services.
Well, we've heard from an emergency room doctor. We've heard from the Bush administration. We turn now to Stuart Altman, professor of health policy at Brandeis University in Waltham, Massachusetts. Good afternoon, professor.
Good afternoon.
Well, tell us straight out, do you think the president's plan is going to work?
Well, I have some sympathy for giving states more flexibility, but what we really need is a massive infusion of federal money into our states. Our Medicaid program, which is really the heart of our safety net system, is in serious trouble. So I'm very sympathetic to the problem of the emergency room physicians and all physicians. If we don't get a restructuring of the financing system, Medicaid can be in serious trouble.
When you say massive infusion, are you talking about more than the Bush administration is offering up front?
Oh, substantially more. We need to have what's called, we call it a countercyclical policy. We ask our states, just when they're in the worst financial shape, to take on a bigger and bigger burden for our uninsured and for people of low income. It ought to be the other way around. This is the time that the federal government should be coming to the aid of our states.
Professor Altman, you say you sympathize with states being asked to be more flexible. Some say that word is a euphemism for, you know, being out on their own and suffering cutbacks. What about the thinking that the move is to make states more responsible and to cut back on their spending?
Well, it's one thing to be more flexible and to take advantage of new opportunities and do things better. And to that extent, I'm supportive of it. But when all gets said and done, these are sick people. These are our aged or disabled. And no amount of flexibility is going to reduce the need for them for more care.
Yeah.
So there's just so much we can save, and we ought to be doing both. Save when needed, but added more money where appropriate.
What do you foresee? You know, people are losing benefits. Elderly people are losing home health aid, prescription coverage. Low-income adults are losing full coverage. What do you see?
I see Medicaid becoming more important in the years to come. I think it is always going to be with us, and we ought to be moving towards national health coverage where everyone's covered, and Medicaid is a key component. So if we don't do something now, I see lots of troubles.
Who will pay?
I think ultimately people will get less care, and those who wind up in emergency rooms, are just what it's going to do is get shifted on to those of us who are privately insured. It's a form of a hidden tax. We need to cover these people or provide them with care, and what happens is it puts added pressure on our hospitals and our other providers to find other sources of money, and the other sources, unfortunately, turn out to be those of us who are privately insured who already are seeing 20-25% increases in our premiums. So it's not like somebody isn't going to pay.
Professor Altman, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Stuart Altman, professor of health policy at Brandeis University.
Still to come, bench-clearing brawls are a thing of the past in the NHL, but the cult of hockey fans who go crazy for the fights is alive and well. We drop the gloves with a former enforcer of the game to find out why.
You're listening to Here and Now.
It's Thursday when we open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts.
Our recent story on internet file sharing and how it's hurting music retailers brought this email from Zach Hoover, who writes, I regret that music stores are being hit hard by this phenomenon, but people are much more music literate thanks to music sharing online. I've certainly benefited from MP3s without spending any more or less at my local record store. I'll still be there for the next Jurassic 5 or Weezer album, but I'll be browsing online.
Well, listener Chris Wood sent this email after hearing our discussion about President Bush's landing aboard the aircraft carrier Abraham Lincoln in a Navy jet. Chris writes, I wanted to write about my father dying with dignity recently, a 91-year-old World War II veteran. But Dad's gift to the country has been tarnished by Bush's staged event. Bush is a man who dodged the opportunity to fly combat in Vietnam and now has the audacity to fly a plane in the safety of peace instead of doing the real thing. This is Bush's version of a fantasy camp.
Peter Caswell of Shrewsbury, Massachusetts, had a bone to pick with our press panel after hearing a recent discussion about the Democratic presidential candidates. Peter writes, could you guys manage perhaps a little more condescension? I mean, I know these guys are only Democrats, not like the obviously unbeatable George W. Other than Mr. Gebhardt's health care plan, which you mentioned only in passing, you didn't mention a single issue that was discussed in the candidates' debate. You guys are supposed to be better than this. We want issues, not Fox TV.
Well, our conversation with the director of state lands in Utah about the Bush administration's change of wilderness regulations, which some say would leave 200 million acres of western land unprotected, prompted Brian McCarthy of Tucson, Arizona, to leave this voice message.
What this person failed to mention is that Secretary Norton's declaration gave a green light to Utah counties to bulldoze lands which are currently protected under Wilderness Study Area designation. Once this is done, that land no longer qualifies for wilderness. This is a terrible thing by the Secretary of the Interior and underlines the Bush administration's opposition to preserving our natural areas.
Thank you, Brian. Also, thanks to the listeners who pointed out that the poem Wage Peace, which we attributed to the poet Mary Oliver, is actually the work of New Mexico poet Judith Hill.
And finally, we received a lot of mail from listeners who appreciated Robin's profile of Robert Young, the terminally ill man from Saco, Maine, determined to live his final days in his own way. Marianne Magruder writes, as a social worker who works with the elderly and cancer patients, I really enjoyed your piece on Robert Young. His outlook and attitude about death are uplifting and will inform my future practice with dying patients. And can you please tell me what the music was that he chose for his funeral?
Well, Marianne, many asked, and the music was Arvo Pärt's Tabula Rasa. And here's some more from that piece.
As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org.
Or you can give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397, 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your name, phone number, and town.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
And the gloves went off simultaneously. Breton, he did it. Watch this. He knew he was in a scuffle. Watch. Bang, bang.
Bang. Good night.
On a recent afternoon, a bunch of guys gathered around the TV watching hockey. Not the Stanley Cup playoffs, which are taking place right now, but a compilation of fights. Sort of a greatest hits, you'll pardon the expression, of the sport.
See, look at those lefts he's pumping right in there. Right
see,
in.
See, I always got Petey at the front of the sweater and he's grabbing on. As soon as he ducks the head, he switches to the uppercut.
Yep.
Then Pete, being the smart fighter, is switches up to the left hand and starts trading them back and forth. Yeah.
In hockey, there are players called enforcers, or goons, whose main purpose is to fight. Some, like Canada's Marty McSorley, who stood trial for hitting a player with a stick, have been criticized. Most stay within the bounds of expected brawl behavior. And while it sounds appalling to some, to others, they're heroes.
Dave the Hammer Schultz, Kevin Killer Kaminsky,
Stu the Grim Reaper Grimson,
Taz, Terry Taz O'Reilly, Rob Razor Ray, Marty the Meat Grinder Melnichuk, one of our favorites, Jacques the Mailman Mayotte, Doug the Thug Smith, which also couples with Doug the Hammer Smith.
Doug the Thug Smith was an enforcer, one of hockey's hired hitmen. He's also author of the book Goon. He says his job was to protect and stand up for other players.
When two hockey fighters meet up with each other and they make eye contact for a couple of seconds, and there could be some words said and, you know, a couple of cross checks here and slashes there. And usually the next step is to drop the gloves, which is the proper way of doing it. It's proper etiquette, so to speak. And they drop their gloves and they fight.
Drop the Gloves is also the name of a website devoted to hockey brawls and the cult following of fight enthusiasts. Recently, we traveled to Newton, Massachusetts to meet up with Doug the Thug Smith and Drop the Gloves founders, Brian Korsman and Jonathan Wright. We found a meticulous basement shrine filled with videotapes, paraphernalia, and computers, and we immediately logged on.
And here we are.
So, Brian, tell me how this started. What was your thinking behind doing this?
Back in high school, I worked as a juice boy with the Boston Bruins, and one of the friends on the team had given me his jersey. And a lot of my friends had asked me if they could buy it from me or if they could get one for themselves. And after a while, I figured with enough people asking me, why not get a collection of them going? And from there, it turned into a business, and I guess it exploded into what it is that we have today.
I cannot believe the subculture that I'm finding out about through your website. Let's go to some of the pictures Okay, stop there. What are these pictures here, John?
This is one picture is of Kevin Killer Kaminsky when he was playing for the Portland Pirates and they won the Calder Cup. That's actually a picture of him in the locker room sipping out of the cup in celebration. And the other picture here is of Big Bad Bob Probert, who's one of the toughest of all time. I think he's given Craig Berube a big fat right hand, actually.
Can people trade these pictures of the fight moments?
Fight pictures actually are a pretty popular thing because they're not really readily available to the general public, which is why people come to us to purchase them.
They're calling you for the pictures even as we speak.
That's right. That's the way it goes. We tend to like it busy around here.
Well, scroll down. Let's see some of the other moments. Oh, now there's one.
That is Dave Brown, and he used to play for the Philadelphia Flyers, was where he really made his mark in the league.
They can't just call him Dave Brown.
Dave Brown is Brownie, and then there's another famous Dave that played for the Flyers, Dave the Hammer Schultz, who is an absolute legend. He changed the way the game was played.
Okay, tell me about the Hammer, because this is the guy apparently who made the idea of being a goon a good one.
He basically was the first guy to go out there and be strictly a fighter, and his only purpose out on the ice was to protect the other players, the skilled players, from being taken advantage of with the physical play. And he set the all-time mark in the NHL for penalty minutes.
That was a good thing?
As far as we're concerned, it is.
Tremendous left by O'Reilly. A choke grabs his jersey and throws some solid rights. What a battle.
So he was the first one for whom it was okay to, you know, you don't score, you don't defend in other ways, you're not maybe a particularly great skater, you just fight.
That was his role on the team, and he afforded other players like the Bobby Clarks and players like that to actually have a little bit more space out on the ice, which would then in turn hopefully into more goals.
And so I'm assuming, let me bring you in here now, Doug Smith, because do I read in your book, Goon, mm-hmm. by the way, please tell people that you are the one who calls yourself a goon, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's a name that most fighters would probably not like to be called.
You took this role to heart, the role of enforcer. I mean, the book opens with you just so excited because you split your face open and you're bleeding. What is that about?
Well, I think basically what it came down to was I was just a regular guy, just like the regular guy who works 9 to 5 and has a dream.
But did you ever dream about scoring?
Unfortunately, no. I could care less about carrying the puck, shooting the puck. I was actually probably afraid because I didn't work on those skills. I understand, and I'm sure a lot of hockey fans understand that, you know, fighting is the barbaric side of the sport. And a lot of people either don't like hockey or don't follow hockey because of the fighting that's allowed. But until they get rid of high stickings and the injuries that occur in the game, there's always going to be someone on the team to stand up to the bad guy on the other side.
The applause you hear is the arrival of Doug Smith on the ice here in the third period. We saw him and Sean Wood and Wormel come out for a couple of shifts in the third or in the first period, but Smith will get one here, and he's going to drop him with number 9, DeGrot, and they're throwing them pretty good. DeGrot and Smith, and Smith has the edge.
On your website, Brian and John, I notice you have forums where people can talk about fights, and they also buy and sell and swap tapes of fights. Now, who does this? Do the players do this as well as the fans?
Well, it's I guess, a good mixture of both. An awful lot of the players enjoy getting their fights from us on tape so they can study upcoming opponents that they're going to have to take on that they haven't fought yet that they may not know about. And then speaking with Doug over the years, you find out that a fighter likes to know if a guy's left-handed or right-handed before the battle. That way you don't get surprised and you know which arm to grab onto and which arm to swing with.
Here's what I want to do. Can we sit down and watch a compilation tape? Because here's my thinking. I think hockey fight, and I think two guys holding onto each other's shirts, pulled over their heads, swinging around a little circle, looking really kind of silly. So let's look at a tape, and I want you to tell me what you're seeing, okay? What kind of move you're seeing. Okay, let's do it.
Okay, we're going to watch a fight right now with Washington's Chris Simon and Atlanta's Darcy Hordachuk, and they're both heavyweights for their team. Heavyweights meaning like they're big, big guys.
Here we seized go. It. Now with the gloves come down, it's Hordachuk and Simon, and Darcy Hordachuk is taking it badly.
Definitely every fighter has their own style. Some guys like to really wind up and try to throw home run hits, you know, big heavy punches, and other guys just throw quick little punches.
And the camera pans off, and there's a bunch of little kids. You know, there are parents who just worry a little bit about the thrashing about that's going out on down on the ice.
I'm sure, but I think parents are also coy to the whole sport itself, and they can explain to their kids that, listen, this is professional hockey. This isn't what you play, peewee hockey or midget hockey when you're a little kid, or even high school hockey. There's absolutely no fighting allowed or tolerated in high school hockey, or college hockey even today.
But, you know, just in the Boston area recently, we had two fathers, or a father who was accused of attacking another father at a hockey rink where kids were playing, and he killed him, and the father ended up dead. And there are people who say that that's because hockey lends itself to that sense that you can fight and that it's accepted.
Well, I don't necessarily agree with that so much as the sense that I think you just have parents, and it's been documented how excited and how overzealous parents get in the stands, and they scream and yell all night, and I don't necessarily think it has to do with hockey fighting. I just think it's two hot-headed parents just getting, you know, a little bit overworked.
Brian and John, what's the strangest request that somebody has made of you, the strangest thing? Give it a second.
We actually had a request for a player's jock strap once, and we found it and sent it up to our client in Canada, and he loves it.
Oh, what a lucky person. Okay, well, you guys, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming. It was a pleasure having you at the office.
And thank you. I do appreciate you taking the time to review my book.
You're welcome, Goon. Doug the Thug Smith is currently a police officer in Hanson, Massachusetts, and author of the biography Goon. Brian Korsman and Jonathan Wright run Drop the Gloves, a website devoted to hockey fights. For more, go to our website, here-now.org, and we'll let Warren Zevon have the final word.
Till a scout from the flames came down from Saskatoon, said there's always room on our team for a goon. Son, we've always got room for a goon. There were Swedes to the left of him, Russians to the right. A Czech at the blue line looking for a fight. Brains over brawn, that might work for you. But what's a Canadian farm boy to do?
It's somebody.
What else can a farm boy from Canada do?
It's somebody.
What's a Canadian farm boy to do?
It's somebody.
What else can a farm boy from Canada do?
Here and Now is a production of WBUR, Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
Was what the crowd roared when Buddy the Goon came over the boards. Coach, he'd say, I want to score goals. The coach said, Buddy, remember your role. The fast guys get paid. They shoot and they score.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at mathworks.com.